It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore J.R.R. Tolkien's fantasy creations and how his manuscripts influenced literature and society with help from the J.R.R. Tolkien Collection at Marquette University that represents an extraordinary body of literary papers, 11,000 original manuscripts, multiple working drafts of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. And now an exhibit opens Friday at Marquette's Hagerty Museum of Art called Tolkien, The Art of the Manuscript. Join in, 800-642-1234. Sarah Schaefer is an assistant professor of art history at UW-Milwaukee, co-curated this exhibition of Tolkien's manuscripts. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. William Fliss is here as well, archivist and curator of the Tolkien Collection at Marquette, and of course had a hand in bringing this exhibit to life. Bill, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, Bill, can you give us a sneak peek? What can visitors expect when they walk through this exhibit?
Oh, it's a wonderful exhibit. What you can expect to see are a number of really interesting pieces from Marquette's collection. As you mentioned in the lead-in, there are over 11,000 pages of manuscript material here at Marquette. And so we've selected a portion of those to show in the exhibition. And also, it's very exciting, we've also reached out to the other great place in the world to go for Tolkien manuscripts, and that's the Bodleian Libraries at the University of Oxford in the UK, where J.R.R. Tolkien spent most of his adult life as a professor. Mm-hmm. And we requested and received permission to borrow a number of items from their collection as well. And so we're bringing together works from our two repositories into the Hagerty Museum, where fans and just casual visitors, people with an interest in language, in literature, in manuscripts can come and enjoy the show.
Sarah, how do you reflect on who Tolkien represents and what you decided to put on display? Because there is this wealth of material that could go into the exhibition. You know, how did you think about Tolkien in reflection of what you wanted to put up?
Yeah, well, we were coming on the heels with this exhibition of a couple of really fantastic and comprehensive exhibitions on Tolkien and his work, one that was mounted at the Bodleian and then at the Morgan Library and Museum in New York, and another one that was at the National Library in Paris. And the sort of benefit of having those exhibitions recently was that it sort of took the onus off of us to try to do something comprehensive. So we instead thought about, well, what are Marquette's strengths? What are the strengths of the Tolkien collection at Marquette? And kind of came to this idea of the manuscript. And the manuscript in a couple of different ways. So one, we have the manuscript as the working drafts, in many cases, unpublished versions of these iconic texts, and then also manuscripts as just handwritten documents. And these were the kinds of objects, the kinds of texts that Tolkien studied and worked with as a philologist at Oxford. And so we honed in on this relationship between those two aspects of the manuscript. And one of the things I'm most excited about and that I sort of became familiar with in researching the exhibition, and that is a core element of it, is how medieval manuscripts, these sources that he worked with closely, how they kind of wend their way in different ways into his legendarium, into the stories that we're so familiar with.
Something to me that's really interesting, Bill, is that, you know, as you talk about manuscripts, Tolkien lived in an era when letters were the main form of communication. You sat down and you wrote a letter, a very thoughtful letter. You didn't text someone, you didn't, you know, post your missives on Twitter. How do his letters give insight into his manuscripts, insight into his life and his writings?
Well, his letters are a really valuable source in Tolkien studies, those people who study Tolkien, because he was a prodigious letter writer, and he oftentimes was very thoughtful in his letters and used them as a platform to really explore his own thoughts about something. And so his letters are very important in that way. And also, one of the things we're highlighting in the exhibition is his artistic ability, particularly in calligraphy, and his handwriting could be absolutely beautiful, different scripts he might use. And so his letters are oftentimes a joy to read just because they're just beautiful, beautiful to look at. Now, some of his working manuscripts are less beautiful. Some of his first drafts, which we have on display in the exhibition, are very difficult to read. And I would challenge some of the visitors to try to make out what he's saying. Some of them are drafts of familiar texts. And so hopefully knowing those who are familiar with the texts will be able to read along and understand what he's saying.
I'm going to reintroduce you both as we talk about the works of J.R.R. Tolkien with Bill Fliss, Marquette University archivist and curator of the Tolkien Collection. Sarah Schaefer is here, assistant professor of art history at UW-Milwaukee, as they talk about the exhibition that opens Friday. You can join in on Tolkien, your questions about the repository, 800-642-1234. Bill, can you give us just a brief backstory as to how Marquette came to acquire so much Tolkien material?
Yeah, it's a remarkable story. I'm happy to give a quick summary of it. It's really remarkable that Marquette has this because Tolkien was English and he never set foot in the United States. So why, you know, the question people ask is, why are these treasures here in Milwaukee on the shores of Lake Michigan of all places? And it's really because of the foresight of the Marquette's library director in the 1950s, William Reedy, who was hired to stock Marquette's library with books and manuscripts. And he was familiar with Tolkien's work. This was just shortly after The Lord of the Rings was published. So it was certainly before Tolkien had become a phenomenon. And he decided that he wanted to inquire about purchasing Tolkien's literary manuscripts. And so he approached Professor Tolkien through an intermediary that acted as Marquette's agent. And sometimes it just pays to be the first to ask. No one else had asked at this point. And Tolkien agreed to sell his manuscripts for what ultimately was four of his works of fiction. We have the manuscripts for The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, which are his two, I think, most famous books. And then two lesser known books, but which are still wonderful. One is called Farmer Giles of Ham, and the other is an illustrated children's book he did called Mr. Bliss. And so the manuscripts have been here. There have been additional manuscripts that have joined the collection over the year, but the core body of manuscripts have been here since 1957, 1958. So they've been here a long time and have drawn researchers to Marquette from all over the world.
And Tolkien died in 1973. I mean, just for frame of reference there, you know, this is in the height of when I would imagine Tolkien is writing, is when you have started to acquire these manuscripts.
Yeah, he was writing his whole life on what's called his legendarium. It's more than just The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. It's a vast body of mythology and world building that he engaged in from the time he was a young man. And one of the neat things about the exhibition is by being able to borrow from the Bodleian's collection, we can bring some of these other works that represent his broader writings and his legendarium here to Milwaukee to be alongside the material that we have for The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. But so he began The Hobbit in 1937, and then The Lord of the Rings followed as a sequel, originally intended as a sequel to The Hobbit, but it grew into much more than that. And it took him many years to write The Lord of the Rings. It was probably about 11 or 12 years before he technically finished a complete draft of it. And then it was there's some additional years while he was getting it ready for publication. So it was a long journey for him.
Sarah, from an art history perspective, what is the significance of Tolkien's manuscripts? Because he also had a whole body of illustrations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. There isn't much of an art historical body of literature on Tolkien at this point. And I hope that the exhibition and the catalog will add to that. And there are a lot of kind of weedsy reasons that have to do with disciplinary history that I won't get into. But one of the things that I hope will come through in the exhibition are the kinds of visual sources and things that really informed characteristics of his illustrations of the ways that he thought about objects like manuscripts. So one of the key objects that sort of formed the basis for the exhibition were these were pages that he crafted. They're basically facsimile pages of a manuscript called the Book of Mazerbal that appears in The Lord of the Rings when the Fellowship is in the Mines of Moria. It's this dwarf chronicle, and he created these really amazing basically invented artifacts. So pages of this manuscript that the Fellowship finds that has blood and stab marks and things like that. And he created these illustrations that were supposed to be, or he hoped would be, part of the published Lord of the Rings. And because of the costs that would have incurred, that they didn't ultimately end up in the book. But to me, these are sort of fascinating objects because they really speak to the way that he actually engaged with the medieval manuscripts that he worked with on a daily basis. And that's, you know, thinking about how objects actually come to people, how reproductions affect their way of engaging with objects is something art historians have been interested in for a long time. So one of the things that I got really interested in doing this research was the fact that, you know, he was at the Bodleian, and there are major manuscripts that he published on, that he studied over decades and decades. And many of these were either, like I said, at the Bodleian or even at the British Library, but nearby. But on a day-to-day basis, he wasn't looking at the physical medieval manuscripts. He was actually looking at published facsimiles. And so I got really interested in the fact that, you know, this kind of reproduction of these manuscripts was, you know, very deeply important on just his on a day-to-day basis of his life as a scholar, and actually helped us a lot in organizing the exhibition. We weren't trying to get the, you know, the one copy of Beowulf that exists, for example, the one original manuscript. We could actually put the facsimiles in there because that's what he would have used.
Oh, fascinating. UW-Milwaukee art historian Sarah Schaefer and Marquette University archivist Bill Fliss, they co-curated Marquette's new exhibit called The Art of the Manuscript, drawing from the vast collection of J.R.R. Tolkien manuscripts housed at Marquette's Rainer Memorial Libraries. Join in on this collection, how you view Tolkien in literature and fantasy works, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the literary creations, the fantasy universe of Middle-earth, and the J.R.R. Tolkien repository of his manuscripts at Marquette. An exhibit opens Friday at their art museum featuring nearly 150 items, many never seen before in an exhibit or published. Join in on what you want to know about the Tolkien collection, how you feel about the Lord of the Rings fandom, 800-642-1234. Bill Fliss is an archivist and curator of the collection, and Sarah Schaefer is here, art historian at UW-Milwaukee. They teamed up on the exhibit called The Art of the Manuscript, and they stay with us. So, Bill, Amazon's The Rings of Power, as you are probably anticipating, will drop next month, early next month, one of the most expensive shows ever made. And I'm really curious about fandom, because you at the repository now collect fandom, and I'm wondering how you approach it, how you see it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see when that show drops. Honestly, I haven't been keeping close tabs on the Amazon show. I think Sarah is tracking it more closely than I am. But I look forward to seeing it. And it could be, just like with the Peter Jackson films, that show will introduce new people to Tolkien and will generate interest in our exhibition and in the study of Tolkien. Regarding fandom, it's very difficult to collect that. I think once the internet emerged, fandom really proliferated and exploded, and it became very hard to track it. Prior to that, Marquette was we've been documenting fandom usually through the fan magazines and publications that different fan groups would produce. But the fandom's become so enormous, it's quite a challenge. One of the ideas I came up with a few years ago, it's a project I'm still working on, is an oral history collection, brief interviews or testimonials from Tolkien fans, kind of sharing a story about how they connected up with the author and why they like him or why they're a fan and what he's meant to them. And I've been gathering those together in a collection, and that's still ongoing. And one of the opportunities that this exhibition provides is that visitors can either, if they're interested, contribute an interview on site or get information that where they can then go and contribute one afterwards.
It's kind of like a Tolkien Story Corps.
Exactly. In fact, StoryCorps was kind of an influence along with just the general trend in podcasting. I was just trying to find a way to sort of document and provide a snapshot of the fandom. Mm-hmm. I set a very lofty goal of 6,000 interviews. And so I've got a ways to go. So I'm definitely looking forward to events like the exhibition for boosting the number of interviews I have.
Well, Sarah, what about Amazon's The Rings of Power? What do you make of it and Tolkien's works appealing to such a mass audience?
We're just talking about this with Bill and some of our friends from the Bodleian who've been out this week about this. One of the things I love is the fact that you can be a fan and a deep, deep fan in such different ways. And that speaks to just the breadth and depth of this, you know, huge creative body that Tolkien created. As far as the show, I mean, I would say I've been tracking it more closely than Bill has, but not deeply so, mostly just because I like to be immersed in a new, you know, creative venture like that. I don't like to do a lot of deep picking and analysis of it before having seen it, but having watched and listened to a lot of people who are deep fans who've been tracking the things that have come out, it's been fun to see how what may have started as kind of broad sort of skepticism or kind of maybe trepidation about the show, which is coming, you know, it's built out of a very small body of published works, actually. Mm-hmm. So seeing that trepidation kind of morph into more genuine excitement. And I think it just as it's become clear that the people who are involved in the show seem to be, you know, very deep fans as well and very respectful of the material and of the fan community that exists already.
And I think it's interesting that the episodes will launch all at the same time around the world. So fans, you know, they can explore it and feel it all together at once. I found that interesting that Amazon would decide to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to look at, let me just reintroduce you here as we talk with Sarah Schaefer, Assistant Professor of Art History at UW-Milwaukee, Bill Fliss, Marquette University Archivist, about the Tolkien collection. Bill, how do you decide what to add to it and when?
Well, I have a lot of networks within the fandom and different sources of information about things to acquire to document that or writings about Tolkien that have emerged. We have tried to be fairly comprehensive at Marquette in terms of collecting new works written about Tolkien. There's quite a burgeoning literature, some of it excellent, some of it maybe not so good, but we try to collect it all and have it. In terms of Tolkien manuscripts that are out there, obviously there's very little out there. It's in terms of the literary manuscripts, really they're all locked up either at Marquette or at the Bodleian, but there are still manuscripts that float around at auction, letters, maybe fragments, pages, advanced proofs of different things. And we found ourselves in a situation where private collectors very much like those things. And so we simply, as an institution, as a repository, struggle to compete with them in acquiring these things. And so we'll oftentimes look for donations. There are people who have, we're correspondents with Tolkien who have donated their letter or letters to Marquette.
We only have a few seconds left, but this is a really fun question to both of you. Really quickly, what would Tolkien say about the COVID pandemic, and where do you think he would have spent his lockdown, and what would he have been doing and writing about? Sarah?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, my guess is he would have been holed up in an office somewhere writing and you know, I don't know, maybe not all that, kind of like me, not all that phased. Like, yeah, I get to be alone and work by myself.
Bill, how about you?
Yeah, I think, I agree. He probably would have been holed up in his study quite a bit. I think it, depending on the nature of the instruction he did and the work he did at Oxford, I think he would, if it afforded him additional free time, I think he would gladly have taken it to begin work on keep working on his stories. He's clearly somebody whose imagination was so fertile. He had so many ideas, and there just wasn't enough time in his lifespan to get them all down. So I think that would have provided him an opportunity to provide us with much more of his creative writing.
Well, Bill and Sarah, thank you both for joining us. Best wishes on the exhibition.
Thank you so much.
Bill Fliss, archivist at Marquette University, curator of their J.R.R. Tolkien collection. Sarah Schaefer, assistant professor of art history at UW-Milwaukee. And that is the Art of the Manuscript exhibit. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about an Army Reserve veteran who now lives in Shawnee County.
Joanne Shedler's family was fighting in wars long before the U.S. military existed. This is one reason the nurse joined the Army Reserve later in life and eventually co-founded the Mohican Veterans Group. Shedler lives in Gresham and shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative.
I was an older nursing student that went to Marquette University in Milwaukee. And after I graduated with my Bachelor's of Science in Nursing, a family member who is an Army recruiter talked to me and said that I could get a direct commission in the Army if I wanted to join it. I thought that was a great opportunity because of the history of my family. As a Native American, we have fought in wars since before the military, U.S. military. I was commissioned as a second lieutenant, which is the bottom ranks of officers. Our reserve unit got called to active duty. We started out at Fort McCoy in Wisconsin. We were in big barracks and it was very dreary. And so we got a little opportunity to run into Walmart and I bought some things to help decorate up our bathroom. The other women really appreciated that. I also am a beautician, which I did before I became a nurse, and I offered free haircuts to people because we were there after 4 months and there was only a barber on the base. And to me, that helped with our morale. And as a leader, I think it showed that you can make the best of whatever situation you're in. I also got a tribal flag that I brought along, and I hung it outside when I got to have a little area where I did have some privacy. And that was kind of cool because it gave a lot of people an understanding that there's Native Americans that are also here. We're a whole variety of people. Parts of our unit were pulled and called up to go to Afghanistan. I volunteered to do that, but by this time I had received my promotion to major. They were looking for ICU nurses, and I was a med surge and administrator at that time. So I did not get the chance to do that, but we stayed on a few more months. And then 2004, I retired after 20 years and 6 months in the Army Reserves. So when I was back home, I became a tribal council person, a legislator for my tribe. As a veteran, I was very interested in our history. So I was a part of our historical society for our tribe. Myself and two other tribal member women who were retired Army, we started the Mohican Veterans about 17 years ago. And so we have our own Mohican Veterans organization. We're formed because we wanna recognize and be at all the funerals as honor guards. And we have an Eagle Staff, which is a memorial Eagle Staff that we've started. And my eagle feather, one of my eagle feathers that I have, when I pass on, my family can give it to our veterans, and then at my funeral, they will tie that eagle feather onto the staff. Our veterans group were instrumental also in putting together a veterans memorial. And in front of our clinic, we have a memorial now. And so every day we can see that there with many names that are there. So we continue to honor our veterans many ways.
That was Joanne Shedler of Gresham, Wisconsin. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to La Crosse, which continues to work with community partners and agencies to end homelessness. The city announced in April that it had put together a plan to make its Huska Park a safe space for unsheltered individuals, with local nonprofits stepping in to provide on-site support services there until the end of October. Join in on the work of ending homelessness, encampments, what you want to know from La Crosse, 800-642-1234. Brian Sampson is Homeless Services Coordinator for the City of La Crosse. Brian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, give us a glimpse. How many people are experiencing homelessness in La Crosse now?
Yeah, so our numbers, like a lot of communities across the state and across the nation, unfortunately continue to rise due to a number of different factors. And so I think about this time we have around 150-ish people who are unsheltered and outside experiencing homelessness in our community.
150-ish. What have you noticed about your city's homeless population in these pandemic times, in this time of inflation, the housing crisis we're in?
Yeah, I think everybody's just in a unique situation. I don't think it's fair to paint with broad strokes when talking about people who are experiencing homelessness, because there's a number of different factors. And because everybody is unique and an individual, then it also takes a lot of different solutions as well. You know, there's not just going to be one plan or one program that's implemented that solves homelessness. It's, you know, we really need a little bit more, a lot more of everything in our community, like a lot of communities. Housing definitely is one of the biggest factors, the lack of housing overall and affordable housing. I think that's just really tough on people. And it just takes, you know, one or two incidents of bad luck or one or two things to go against someone's way, and it can really spiral and go downhill from there. And so I think that's really just, these are our neighbors, these are our community members that we're trying to support, our family members. And so I think just trying to understand where each person is coming from, build those relationships on the front line, and get to know what it's going to take to find housing, to help somebody find housing, and then to help that person stay in housing.
And you're the city's first ever homeless services coordinator. As you mentioned, there's not a single plan that will end homelessness. And I would imagine that you alone can't do it either. But what are you focused on in your role in working with other organizations? What are you connecting?
Yeah, so my role is really just to help coordinate a community approach, put the experts, put the right people in the right rooms at the right time, and just help everybody have the opportunity to make the plans that are necessary to support, you know, really in a crisis. So what needs to happen right now in the crisis? And then also, what is the long-term planning? Because this didn't just happen overnight, where our numbers didn't just explode overnight. It was years in the making. And so it's not going to just be fixed, so to speak, in a night or in a short period of time. So really in my role, just coordinating, you know, who needs to be at the table, what conversations need to be had, and how can we all continue to move forward. You know, the service providers, the housing agencies are doing a lot of really good work and are working extremely hard. You know, they're working overtime. People who are experiencing homelessness are partnering with them. And so it's really just trying to kind of make sure we're all facing the same direction and rowing in the same direction.
What do you think, what have been the most fruitful conversations?
I think it's talking about what can we do right now to help support people? Because we have a lot of people camping at Huska. And so what can we do right now to help people start planning for the winter? I think that's really been a conversation that's produced quick results, where people trying to support those who are camping at Huska and how can they start planning right now for where they're going to go for the winter. And then also it's really just about that long-term support and starting right now, but also moving forward, how can we support them and being successful in the long term? Because that's really what it's about, is not just finding housing, but then once you're in housing, whatever support and services that that person may need, how can we set them up with that? Because that's also in our community and in most, if not all, communities across the state and the nation, that it's those wraparound services too. You know, we need more housing and more wraparound services. We need more of everything.
Let's back up for a moment on Huska Park. So in February, the La Crosse Parks Board of Commissioners approves Huska Park as an official location for the homeless in the community. Can you explain how many people are living there in tents at the park and what services are ongoing?
Yeah, so as far as the numbers, it's very difficult to get an exact number. I would say a rough estimate of 115 to 140-ish people are there at any given time. And as far as services, there are a lot of agencies that are going down to the park to provide different services. So there's Independent Living Resources has an outreach team that goes down there 3 or 4 days a week to build relationships, to help connect people with resources. There's an organization called WIN, which stands for What I Need Now, who's down there. They hand out any supplies people may need. They have really good relationships with people who are staying there, which I think is a key factor in helping people move forward toward housing, is it starts with those relationships.
Trust.
Yep, exactly. So they're down there. And there's a number of other agencies. Karuna has a couple of their employees who go down there to help transport people for showers or for laundry if that's needed. There's through the community, we've really asked the community to help support this as well. So the community has stepped up with different donations of tents, because tents really are not made to be lived in. You know, they're made for camping. And so the weather is very hard on them. They're not made for everyday use over and over again. And so the community has been helpful in that aspect. There's a sign up that we have in the community for people who, organizations who may want to provide meals. And so on most nights of the week, I would say there's at least one different different organization that will come down there and provide a meal as well. And then it's really just about, you know, we know where part of the thought behind this was, it's not perfect, but we know where people are. And hopefully, because we know where people are, we can help set them up with resources, and then people know where to find them again to follow up and to problem solve instead of trying to have to search throughout the whole city. So I think, you know, that was part of the intention of having those relationships and knowing where to find people as well.
Brian Sampson with us coordinates homeless services for La Crosse as we examine the coordinated approach of this work to end homelessness. Join in on the lack of affordable housing, on poverty, the complexities of addiction, mental health and homelessness, solutions that are starting to emerge in your community and why. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about the steps La Crosse is taking to end homelessness. The U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness says over 4,500 people in Wisconsin are experiencing homelessness on any given day. Still time to talk about the work underway in your community, what you want to know about La Crosse's approach, 800-642-1234. Brian Sampson is La Crosse Homeless Services Coordinator and stays with us. Brian, then what will people living in tents in Huska Park do when winter comes?
Yeah, so that's a multi-tiered approach that the community has implemented. We've done some intense winter planning here the last couple of months. And so the first step really is diversion, which begins today and moving forward is there's a team of service providers from different housing agencies who will meet with everyone to talk to them about what their winter plans are will be, to talk with them about and they have friends or family or other accommodations that they can make, and really starting that conversation immediately today and here in the next couple of weeks about what will people's plans will be, because Huska Campground will be closing at the end of October. And because it's a licensed campground, that, you know, that permit ends at the end of October and people won't be able to stay there. And so really those different service providers are meeting with individuals to start that planning process and helping them figure out where they can go throughout or where they can go for the winter.
So it'll be a case by case basis, individually meeting with the people who are living there. So, you know, looking at what happened when the city used about $700,000 in federal funds to temporarily house people at a hotel in La Crosse, that agreement ended earlier this year. Are there any plans such as that in the works?
No, the city doesn't have any plans to rent out a hotel again this year. We want to, we're committed to helping people who are experiencing homelessness. And what the research shows and the evidence shows is long-term solutions are the best way to do that. So we have been working to figure out if there's a plan for the short term and that could morph into a long-term solution. And at this time, there are no plan or there are not plans and will not be a hotel rented again for this year. And so we've reached out to partner with the different shelters in our community as well to see what it would take to maximize their capacity as well and how we could support them in doing that if that's a possibility. And so I would say that's another tier of the plan of seeing what that looks like. And everyone has limitations right now, you know, with lack of resources just overall, and that's not just financial, you know, human resources, people resources as well. So that's the other part of our plan is trying to help people get to a safe alternative place and seeing how we can best use or maximize the existing resources in our community.
Our state has a really big budget surplus. If you met with the governor, how would you propose to use the surplus on ending homelessness? And where would you tell him to direct the money?
Yeah, so housing, I would say housing and supportive services. And I think those are the two biggest things. So it's, you know, we operate on a housing first mantra, which means that we want to get people into housing first and then really focus on how we can help support them with their mental health or addiction. You know, staying in a place like Huska Campground, it's unrealistic to expect people to be sober when there's a lot of trauma that they're experiencing over and over again every day. That's what I would ask for is resources for more housing in our community, but then also the supportive services that people need to stay in housing and be successful, because the first step is just housing, but that's not the only step. Also, a number of people need those supportive services. I'm not going to say everybody, but each person is in their own situation. And so figuring out then what would those supportive services look like? Maybe some people just need light touch points. Maybe people need more intensive services. So just figuring out what that would look like and the housing and supportive services is what we would ask for.
You mentioned the words housing first, and I was reading up on Salt Lake City's Housing First program, which is focused on really quickly putting people into permanent housing, and there aren't the requirements for eligibility or sobriety or treatment or participation. What do you think of a program like what's going on in Salt Lake?
Yeah, that's the underlying theory that a lot of housing agencies work with, and that at the city, I should just speak for the city that we support is that housing is just the first step, without any conditions, without any requirements, and then working with the person from there to support them in achieving their goals and whatever that looks like, and helping them to achieve whatever that support looks like that they want, and staying in housing and being successful. So that's really the approach that the city takes, is helping people get into housing and then really just customizing that approach with them and what those services that they want would look like in order for them to be successful.
We're talking about homelessness in La Crosse and the approach the city is taking. Brian Sampson is the city's homeless services coordinator. You can join in, still time, 800-642-1234. You talk about these wraparound services, and I just want to dig in more there, because the relationship between substance use and mental health and homelessness is really complex. How do you approach those issues? Are they barriers to achieving housing stability?
Yeah, they're definitely complicating factors. Anytime, and they go hand in hand. You know, it's a lot of times people have experienced trauma. Living on the streets is traumatizing, and that causes, you know, people learn then how to cope with that trauma. When you're in that intense environment every single day, you find a way to survive. And there's some people, the way that they survive is through drugs and or alcohol. And I think that's just the natural survival mechanics of the human brain. And so it's just supporting people. It's a process, you know. It's not like you just go into a house one night and then all of a sudden all of those traumatic experiences or difficulties disappear. It's a process that takes time to heal, really. It's talking about helping people heal and helping people heal their brain so that way they can feel safer and can make safer choices. And so it's really that process, and it's different for everyone. So I don't want to say that every single person who's experiencing homelessness uses drugs and or alcohol, because that's not true. And I think that's part of the negative stereotype and stigma that's unfalse and the bad rap that people who are on the streets get. And so it's really just those relationships. I bring it back to that, is starting with those relationships that are built on the ground every single day, and customizing the approach for each person and figuring out what that person wants and needs.
A few seconds left, but, you know, someone listening now may have never experienced homelessness before. And there is that thought that perhaps some people who are homeless choose a life on the street. What would you say to that thinking?
I would say that, sure, there are some people that I'm sure choose a life to be homeless. And that doesn't speak for the huge numbers that we're experiencing across the state and across the country. We've talked a lot about complicating factors. I would say the rate of rent is a big thing too. And not placing that blame on landlords or on anyone, because we all have to make a living. But I would say that's also problematic, is with rent rising, and especially in our community, you know, the supply is low and the demand is high. And so that makes it difficult as well.
Brian, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Brian Sampson is Homeless Services Coordinator for the City of La Crosse. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.